We're still on slide six, and I've talked about the P generation, the F1 generation already. I didn't talk about what's shown here in the F2 generation. How do you get the F2 generation? Yeah. Right. It's an F1 crossed with another F1 to get the F2. And remember that the F1s, since we started with true breeding parentals, all of the F1s are heterozygous. You can tell that just by the diploid genotype, right? Upper, lower P. So when you make the F2 generation, of course you need gametes from each of those two F1s. And you could write the cross, I mean, you could describe the cross symbolically as upper lower P crossed with upper lower P. That produces the F2. Each of these parents, though, is a heterozygous individual, and therefore each of them can make two different kinds of gametes. That's what heterozygous means. Each of them can make other kind or different kinds of zygotes depending on which gamete they pass to the offspring. And that's because meiosis, remember, randomly chooses one homologue of each type, either the red one or the blue one, right? And one of those is carrying the uppercase P for the chromosome that carries the flower color gene. All the other chromosomes we're ignoring. But the one that carries, that has the flower color gene locus, one of the homologues is going to have an uppercase P, one's going to have a lowercase P. So that means this parent can make two kinds of gametes when all you care about is flower color. It can make a gamete passing the uppercase P, or it can make a gamete passing the containing the lowercase P. Same thing for the other parent. It's just will be the other kind of gamete, sperm or egg. So that brings us to this box that we see right here, which is called a Punnett square, in honor of an Englishman who started doing it. It's just a shorthand notation, really. It represents real things, though. The overall Punnett square represents a biological process. What process is that? Inheritance is involved in the process, but what is the specific process that is the defining process of sex?
Fertilization,
exactly. A Punnett square represents a fertilization event involving two specific parents. That's what the cross tells you, what the parents are, the cross notation. And what is required for fertilization? Or what is fertilization?
Egg and sperm.
Egg and sperm are gametes. What is fertilization? Yes. Fertilization is the fusion of two unicellular gametes to produce one unicellular zygote. If you don't have that happening, then no matter what else anyone is doing, it's not sex. That's why I say it's the fertilization defines sexual reproduction. So those are the requirements of fertilization. Two gametes, one from each parent. And a Punnett square really is just an exhaustive listing of all the possible gametes that those particular two parents can make. On top of the square itself, you list all the possible gametes from one parent. And I'm not talking about the almost infinite number of possible gametes like I was talking about before, because we're ignoring all the other characteristics except for flower color. So we're focusing on one gene here. And when that's all you care about, this parent can produce only two kinds of sperm. The other parent can produce only two kinds of eggs. You know, you have two choices of P, uppercase or lowercase, for each. So on top of the box and to the side of the box, you list all of the possible gametes that these two particular parents can produce. Then you just match them up, a sperm with an egg, because that's what fertilization is, right? And specifically, random fertilization. Remember I talked about the three sources of additional variation that sex allows for. And those were crossing over, independent assortment, both of which happened independently in each of the two parents during meiosis. And then the third is random fertilization, which means you choose randomly from the possible gametes that one parent can make, and then you choose randomly from the possible gametes that the other parent can make, and that gives you your possible types of zygotes. So when you match these things up and fill in the boxes within the Punnett square, each box represents a real thing also. It represents a zygote. Notice that the genotypes for the gametes are haploid gametes. Haploid genotypes. There's only one letter in each. Gametes should be haploid, right? The whole idea is to make haploid gametes so that when you get them together, you're only doubling it back to diploid. You don't keep doubling it every generation. So meiosis in these plants produces the gametes, so that brings it back to haploid. But the genotypes for all the zygotes in the boxes are diploid, as you would expect, right? Because fertilization doubles the ploidy. Well, this Punnett square is not only an exhaustive listing of the gametes that these two particular parents can make when you focus your attention on just the one characteristic, but the boxes are also exhaustive. It's an exhaustive listing of every possible zygote that these parents can make when all you care about is flower color. All right, so the fact that there are four boxes in this particular Punnett square does not at all mean that these parents are going to have four offspring. They could have one offspring or a billion offspring or anything in between. What these four boxes say is that however many offspring these two parents have, every individual offspring is going to start out as one of these four possible types of zygotes. All right? And notice that when you make these zygotes, you're just matching up sperm with egg, column with row, to determine the genotypes. So uppercase, 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 lowercase, and so on. That means, so any Punnett square is a prediction. This Punnett square says that there are these particular four zygotes possible, but notice that two of them are heterozygous. They're really the same, even though there's two ways it can happen. You can get the uppercase P from the father or the uppercase P from the mother. They're really the same situation, though, right? They're both upper lower P. But anyway, not only are these the possible zygotes, but this tells you predictively what the ratio should be in the offspring, however many are produced. And what this says is that three of four, 75% of however many offspring are produced, are predicted to be purple in color, purple-flowered individuals. Whereas one quarter should be white-flowered. And that's almost exactly what Mendel got, because he bothered to do it enough times to get a big sample size. If you do this for a billion rather than 1,000, you're going to be even closer to exactly 750 million in that case, right? And 250 million of white. So that's the power of high sample sizes. This F2 ratio is a famous Mendelian ratio. This is nothing special about flower color. This is a 3-to-1 dominant individual to recessive individual ratio that we see over and over in the F2 generation for a Mendelian genetic, for a cross that operates in a Mendelian fashion. In other words, for Mendelian genetics. So what kind of cross was this originally? What did I say this kind of cross is an example of? Yeah.
Between two purebreds?
Yeah, but what is the term that describes...
homozygous?
It's... No, each of the parents is homozygous. Which is another name for true breeding, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, how many characteristics are we looking at here? No. One characteristic. What is it? Flower color. Right. And notice that the parents differ with respect to the traits for that one characteristic. One is purple trait and one is white trait. Therefore, this kind of cross is called what? Monohybrid. Did I not give you this word before?
No.
Oh, well, no wonder you have no idea.
This is called a monohybrid cross. The hybrid part of the word
refers to a mixture. Like, you know, we use that word hybrid for various kinds of mixtures. In a genetic cross, what the hybrid part of the word refers to is that the parents in the P generation differ in their traits for whatever characteristic you're focusing on. One is purple, one is white. You could cross a purple with a purple, but that wouldn't be a hybrid cross. Okay? And specifically, it's a monohybrid cross. Mono means one, because you're ignoring every characteristic except just one. There's only one characteristic that you're focusing on. That's a monohybrid cross.
So monohybrid would just be saying both parents are homozygous?
Well, it is true that these parents are true breeding, but what makes it monohybrid is that there's one characteristic we're focusing on, which is flower color. That's the one part, the mono part. And so what I'm saying, or what I was about to say about this Punnett square, this 3-to-1 ratio, is that you see this not just for flower color. You see this for any Mendelian characteristic if you conduct a monohybrid cross. So we already looked at the 8 different experiments that Mendel did, right? That was slide 4. These 8 experiments are all monohybrid crosses. The only thing that's different about them is what the specific characteristic that was being focused on is. He cared about flower color here and nothing else. He cared about flower position here and nothing else, and so on. Well, in every one of these, he got an almost exactly 3-to-1 ratio of dominant individuals in the F2 to recessive individuals in the F2. And that's what the Punnett square predicts. That's why it happens, because there's 3 ways. If you start with 2 heterozygous parents, there's 3 ways that they can produce a zygote that is dominant, and there's only one way that they can produce a zygote that is recessive. Now this assumes, this is why I was saying that you have to have a Mendelian gene working here. This assumes the assumptions of Mendelian genetics. Did I already tell you about these 2 assumptions?
No.
Okay, well, I think I might have mentioned that the first half of the slideshow is basically about Mendelian genetics, which isn't all of, not all inheritance patterns follow what we've studied so far. There are some exceptions to this, and those are collectively called non-Mendelian genetics. But for a gene to behave in a Mendelian fashion, which is how you will get these ratios that we're looking at, there has to be 2 things true. One is that there is exactly two possible traits for the characteristic that you're studying. Not more than two. And of course, it's certainly possible for there to be more than two, right? Like eye color, there's not just two eye colors in the population. But for a Mendelian gene to behave this way, there has to be exactly two traits possible. Well, what is it that what physical things correspond to traits? Well, phenotype and trait really are kind of interchangeable. But I'm talking about an object. A phenotype is a quality. What actual physical thing? Not gene. Genes correspond to what? Or a gene corresponds to what?
Characteristic.
A characteristic. What corresponds to a trait?
An
allele. So I've just said that for one of the assumptions of Mendelianity is that there has to be exactly two traits for the one characteristic you're focusing on. Another way of saying that is that there has to be exactly two alleles in the population possible for the one gene that you're focusing on because of that correspondence. Does that make sense? All right, well, let's go back to where I was. So, in 7, we can see this famous 3-to-1 ratio that you get in the F2 if you have a Mendelian gene. I didn't give you the second assumption, I'm sorry. One of the assumptions is that you have to have two alleles exactly for the gene that you're studying. The other assumption is that one of those two alleles needs to be completely dominant over the other. And that was also true for all 8 of Mendel's experiments. But what does it mean to be completely dominant? That means that for an individual to have the dominant phenotype or the dominant trait requires only one dominant allele. You can have two dominant alleles, but it doesn't make you any more dominant in the phenotype. That's why the F1 generation, those flowers were just as purple, even though those were heterozygous individuals, as the homozygous dominant parent, the purple-flowered parent, right? That's what complete dominance tells you. It takes at least one dominant allele, but that's enough to give you fully the dominant phenotype. That's the second requirement for genes to behave in a Mendelian fashion. That's what we mean when we're talking about Mendelian genetics. But notice that, let me talk about this 3-to-1 ratio again. You can see this ratio on the left side of slide 7. Since this is a ratio describing phenotypes or traits, this is called the phenotypic ratio. 3-to-1. 3 dominant individuals for every 1 recessive individuals. So if you were 1,000 of them were produced, you would expect 750 of them to be purple and 250 of them to be white. And so on. But notice that there's 2 different genotypes in a Mendelian gene. There's 2 different genotypes that can give you the same phenotype because of complete dominance. In other words, a dominant individual has the dominant trait, but could be either homozygous dominant or heterozygous. Both of them will be equally dominant in the phenotype, but they will have different genetic makeup, right? And so there's a corresponding ratio called the genotypic ratio, which involves 3 numbers, not just 2. Because if you look at the Punnett square, for instance, those 4 possible zygotes are really of 3 types. upper P, upper lower P, and lower lower P. Those two diagonals, let me go back to the Punnett square for a second. The two diagonals with purple flowers are really two of the same, right? Upper lower P. They're both heterozygous. So, from the Punnett square, you can see that there should be a 1:2:1 genotypic ratio. 1/4 of them should be upper upper P, in other words, homozygous dominant. Half of them should be heterozygous, and 1/4 of them should be homozygous recessive. That's what the right half of slide 7 shows you. The 2 comes from the fact that there's two ways to be heterozygous. Dominant from the father or dominant from the mother. But because of complete dominance, that one dominant that you get if you're a heterozygous individual is enough to make you just as dominant in the phenotype as a homozygous dominant. Okay. Let's go on to 8 now. This is exactly the same cross we've already looked at. I'm sorry, it's not. I was confused on which slide I was on. This is another cross involving flower color, but this is not a monohybrid cross as we've just described it. This is an example of what's called a test cross. And a test cross, as the name implies, is trying to determine something. It's testing for something. Well, if you have a purple-flowered pea plant, just by looking at it, you can tell, you don't even have to touch it or anything, right? You can tell what its phenotype is, since this is a visual phenotype, right? Flower color, the purple flower color tells you, well, this is a dominant individual. You know its phenotype simply by observing. But because of what we just got done talking about in the last slide, you can't, just by looking at it, tell what its genotype is. Because there are two different genotypes that lead to the same purple phenotype. In other words, if you see a purple-flowered pea plant, you know that it's dominant in its phenotype, but you don't know whether it's homozygous dominant or whether it's heterozygous. And knowing the genotype could be valuable. For instance, if you're trying to produce a true breeding stock, a homozygous dominant stock, you wouldn't want heterozygous individuals in that, right? That's why this kind of test cross was created. So this kind of test cross is used to determine the genotype of an individual with the dominant phenotype. Now, if you have an individual with the recessive phenotype, a white-flowered plant, you can tell, of course, by looking at it that it's recessive in its phenotype, just like you can tell the purple one is dominant. But just by looking at the recessive individual, you also, without even touching it, know what its genotype is, because there's only one way to have the recessive genotype, or recessive phenotype, white. It has to be homozygous recessive, right? Because of complete dominance for that gene. So you wouldn't have to conduct such a test cross. You can tell by white-flowered individuals that they are true breeders. They're homozygous recessive. Purple ones, though, dominant phenotype individuals, you have to ascertain the genotype, and that's what this test cross is for. So what you do is cross it with a recessive individual. That's why the white-flowered one's up here. Now, there are two Punnett squares shown here. Earlier today, I was talking about the fact that any given Punnett square is a prediction, right? It tells you what you should predict in the, or what is predicted in the offspring as far as ratios are concerned, or possibilities. There are two Punnett squares here because there are two possibilities here in this thing that you're trying to determine the genotype of. You know that it's purple. You don't know what its genotype is. You know its phenotype. You don't know its genotype. There's two possible phenotypes, though, right? Homozygous dominant and heterozygous. One of those has to be true, otherwise it wouldn't be purple. So you devise two separate Punnett squares, each one on the assumption that the genotype is one or the other possibility. If the genotype actually is upper P, that's one of the two possibilities, then you would make this Punnett square when you cross it with the white. And notice that's going to produce only one possible kind of zygote. There's four here, but they're all the same. It would mean every offspring would have to be purple because they're all heterozygous and it's complete dominance. On the other hand, if the purple flower actually is heterozygous, then you would have this Punnett square. And that would predict half of the offspring being purple, half of them being white. Well, once you have these predictions, you simply go through with the actual cross and look at the real offspring and see what it matches, see which Punnett square it matches. If you get even one white flowered offspring, it can't be this one that predicts the zero white ones, right? So it would have to be this. But this also shows you the power of large sample size, because if you just had one offspring and it's purple, well, it could be either, right? You could have gotten just lucky here, or it could have been this one. So if it's much better, it works much better if the cross produces a lot of offspring. If you have 20 and they're all purple, yes, it would be mathematically possible for this to be true, but it would be unlikely. It would be like flipping a coin 20 times and getting 20 heads or 20 tails. Same odds. Okay, now to 9. This is another cross we're looking at, but it's a little bit different, not only in because we're not concerned with flower color anymore. How many characteristics are we looking at here? Two. What are they? Seed shape is one, and seed color is one. Exactly. And those don't have anything to do with each other. It just happens to be that we are simultaneously tracking both of them. Rather than focusing on just one characteristic, which is usually what we do, we're now simultaneously focusing on two, even though they don't necessarily have anything to do with each other, and we're ignoring all the other characteristics. But also notice that the parental generation involves parents that differ in their traits. So this is a hybrid cross, because the parents do differ in their traits. But it's a dihybrid cross, di meaning two, because instead of focusing on a single characteristic, we're focusing on two. You're correct that there are two characteristics. How many traits are there? Four overall, but two for each characteristic, right? And therefore, it's still a Mendelian situation. Or it still could be, at least. There are two requirements to fulfill for Mendelian characteristics, right? One has to be that there is exactly two traits for the characteristic, and that's true here, right? For seed color, there are exactly two possibilities, red and green. yellow and green. Actually, you can't tell this from looking at that. When I mean two possibilities, I mean in the population, not just in these parents. But yes, it is true that in the population, there's no other colors. Yellow allele and a green allele for seed color. And similarly, in the population, there's only two alleles for texture or shape, which is smooth and wrinkled. But that is not enough to say definitely it's Mendelian, right? The other requirement is that one of those two alleles has to completely dominate over the other. And that's true for both of these characteristics. Yellow is the dominant color. It completely dominates over green. And smooth is the dominant texture. It completely dominates over wrinkled. So this is exactly the same, works exactly the same way as a monohybrid cross. You're just doing two of them at the same time, basically. You could actually write this out separately as two separate monohybrid crosses, you would get the same results. It's just all combined here. Look at the genotypes of the parents here. These parents, by the way, if you could, just by looking at the pictures of them, you can see that they differ in their characteristics. I mean, in their traits. I'm sorry. But when you look at their genotypes, you can see not only are they differing in their traits, but each parent individually is a doubly homozygous individual. Doubly meaning they're homozygous in each of the two characteristics being studied. This yellow round one is doubly homozygous dominant. Homozygous dominant for seed color, homozygous dominant for seed shape. Where the hell did that go? The other parent is doubly homozygous recessive. Homozygous recessive for seed color, homozygous recessive for seed shape. You can't tell that by looking at the pictures, but you should be able to tell it by looking at the genotypes next to the pictures. Now, why do these genotypes have four letters in them each? Yeah. Two alleles for one trait, but we're listing two traits, right? I mean, two characteristics. So these are what ploidy? This upper upper Y, upper upper R is what ploidy genotype? Diploid, right. It's simply that we're simultaneously listing the genotypes for two different genes. So the fact that there's two Ys means it's diploid. The fact that there's two Rs means it's diploid. As you'd expect these parent plants to be, right? And once again, the letter is an initial for the dominant characteristic. So Y for yellow, even if it's green, it's lowercase y in that case. R for round, even for wrinkled, but it's a lowercase r for that. Okay, so this is exactly like flower color. Since these are true breeders, since these are homozygous individual parents, it doesn't matter which chromosome meiosis randomly chooses. It's going to choose an upper Y either way here and an upper R. So the only kind of gamete, when all you care about are these two characteristics, that this parent can make is upper Y, upper R. Notice that that is a haploid genotype, as it should be for a gamete. The other one can make only lower Y, lower R. Well, that means when these two gametes get together, there's only one possible type of zygote, a double heterozygous individual. Upper lower Y, upper lower R. And because of complete dominance, that means the one upper Y is enough to make it fully yellow, and the one upper R is enough to make it fully round. So it's exactly the same thing like in the flower color one, just for two different characteristics simultaneously. All of the F1 generations are going to be yellow-seeded, round-seeded. But when you then cross those to produce the F2, we're confronted here with two different Punnett squares to look at. And that's because there's two possibilities being looked at here, two hypotheses. Each hypothesis, of course, is a possible explanation, right? The hypothesis here, the hypotheses, are for dependent assortment versus independent assortment. Well, I've already spoiled this for you, right? Because you already know from what I've told you in a different lecture that real assortment in meiosis happens independently, not dependently. But what does independent assortment mean in meiosis? Yes, it's metaphase.
Well, metaphase 1 and 2 and anaphase 1 and
2. No, metaphase 1 only.
Oh.
That's when independent assortment occurs.
Yeah.
And it is true that they independently assort, but what does assortment refer to?
Each choice, each one is either going to go
blue top, red bottom, or red top, blue bottom?
For each tetrad, which is a pair of homologs, exactly. You have n tetrads lining up in metaphase one, right? The assortment is how that individual tetrad lines up, whether red up, blue down, or blue up, red down. That is assortment. Independent assortment means that each one lines up independently of the others. Well, if you did have dependent assortment, that would mean they would all be either red up, blue down, or they would all be blue up and red down. They all depend on each other. So those are the two possibilities being investigated here. And that's why you have two Punnett squares, just like in that test cross before, for two possibilities. Well, if the assortment is actually dependent, and you already know that it's really not, but if it were, then you would get this Punnett square, meaning the only possible zygote types, since the chromosomes of different types, and these chromosomes are on different, I mean, these genes are on different chromosomes, but since with dependent assortment, the chromosomes go as a package, all of them in the same direction, basically, to the same cell, then the Punnett square predicts only zygotes that are like one parent or the other. Three of these in the small Punnett square are exactly like the one parent. The other one is like the other parent. And we call these zygotes that are like one parent or the other parental types. On the other hand, if there's independent assortment, then you should get more possibilities. That's why this is a bigger Punnett square. 16 boxes in it. You still have parental types in here, the yellow smooth ones and the green wrinkled one. Those are parental types because they're like one parent or the other. These other ones that aren't like either parent are called recombinant individuals. Because they recombine traits from both parents. They take one trait from one parent and another trait from another parent. And those include the ones that are yellow but wrinkled, or the ones that are green but smooth or round. Okay, those are recombinant. And when you actually go through with this cross, like Mendel did, and let the F2 grow up and produce their own seeds, and you look at those seeds, then you get the ratio predicted by this bigger Punnett square, experimentally indicating that real assortment in meiosis is independent, not dependent. And by the way, this is a new ratio. We talked about the 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio for an F2 with a Mendelian characteristic if it's a monohybrid cross. Well, here we have a dihybrid cross that has its own special ratio, and you'd get this with other characteristics as well, not just seed color and seed shape, but it's 9-to-3 to 3-to-1. 9, you expect 9/16ths, when you add these up, it's 16, which is the number of zygotes shown here. 9 of them you would expect to be, 9 of every 16 you would expect to be doubly homozygous. Doubly dominant, right? Dominant color, dominant shape. 3 of them you would expect to be dominant color, recessive shape. 3 you expect to be recessive color, dominant shape. And only 1 of every 16 you expect to be doubly recessive. Recessive color, recessive shape. And that's exactly what you see if you actually go through with this. These numbers here are Mendel's real numbers. Okay. In 10, these coins just represent the fact that all of this is random. The choosing of gametes is random. That's what random fertilization refers to. Gametes are randomly made to begin with in meiosis in these plants because of the randomness of crossing over and independent assortment. But when the gametes are then produced in each of the two parents, One of them is randomly selected for to make a zygote, and one of them from the other parent. So when you restrict your attention to a single characteristic, and you're crossing two heterozygous individuals, you have this Punnett square. Each parent can make only two kinds of gamete, right? And they're equally possible. And therefore, it's exactly like flipping a fair coin. A truly fair coin has an exactly one-half chance of being heads and exactly one-half chance of being tails. Similarly for the other parent. But to make this particular zygote, which would be upper-upper R, a homozygous dominant individual, would require you to flip a head for this parent and a head for that parent. Each of those individual flips has an odds of 50% or one-half. The chance of doing both of those, which is required to make this zygote, is therefore the mathematical product of those two probabilities. Half times a half is a quarter. And every one of these four possible zygotes has exactly the same chance of actually happening because of this. It's just a probabilistic view of what's happening molecularly. Now, slide 10 ended the part of the slideshow about Mendelian genetics. And I said a little bit earlier that not everything happens that way, because sometimes you have violations of those assumptions that we talked about. Remember, the assumptions were, for Mendelian genetics, the assumptions were that there are exactly two alleles for whatever gene you're studying, no more, in the population, and one of those two alleles completely dominates over the other. It's not always true. So when it's not true, you still have inheritance. The genes are still operating the same way, but you don't get these same familiar patterns, these familiar ratios that we just talked about. And those exceptions to Mendelian genetics are collectively called non-Mendelian genetics. And that's what we're looking at for the next several slides, starting in 11. Now, this first exception in this slide is called incomplete dominance. And you can tell just by hearing the name that this must be an exception, right? Because one of the requirements for Mendelian genetics is complete dominance. Well, incomplete is not complete. So obviously this is not Mendelian. How many characteristics are we dealing with here? No. One characteristic, which is what? Flower color. Just like before, except these are not peas. We also have a cross where the parents differ in their traits. One is red-flowered, one is white-flowered. And they are both true breeding. They're both homozygous. We have a dominance situation here. Red is dominant over white, just like purple was dominant over white. Notice the genotypes, though. They're a little bit different. Unfortunately, there's more than one standard, which is kind of oxymoronic, because if it's a standard, there's supposed to only be one. But instead of using R, upper and lower, like we were doing before with the purple, C here stands for the coloration gene, and you get either an R superscript or a W superscript. Otherwise, it's the same thing. But you can tell by these genotypes that they're homozygous, right? This one's homozygous dominant, this one's homozygous recessive. Therefore, each of them is only able to make one kind of gamete with respect to flower color. And therefore, when you get them together, every one of the F1 generations should be the same genetically. They're all going to be C upper R, C upper W. I mean, super W, superscript W. Yeah?
Are all incomplete dominants, do they all have superscripts? Or can they also do the uppercase, lowercase?
No, I'm going to say no, even though I can't come up with an example, simply because there are so many different standards that people use. So just no, that doesn't have to be. Now, here's where it's different, though. Yes, every one of these F1 flowers, I mean plants, is heterozygous. But unlike the pea plants, the flower color of these heterozygous is not the dominant color. I mean, it's not the color of the dominant parent. The dominant parent is the red flower, right? Well, that's what makes this incomplete dominance. Unlike complete dominance, incomplete dominance means that in order for an individual to fully have the dominant phenotype, requires both alleles in that diploid individual to be the dominant type. In other words, only homozygous dominant individuals are phenotypically fully dominant, fully red in this case. Yes, red dominates over white, but if you're a heterozygous individual, you have only one red allele, and that makes you only partially red, which is pink. And this just depends on the gene. For pea plants, having just one purple allele is enough to make you fully purple. In this species, having just one red allele is not enough. That's what makes it incomplete dominance. If you think about this molecularly, based on what you have learned genes do, it kind of makes sense. A gene is an indirect code for how to make a protein, right? And a protein is what directly give individuals their traits. In this case, the flower color. But if you start with the DNA, if you're a heterozygous individual, only one of your two homologs of the chromosome that carries the flower color gene is the red allele, has the red allele. So when it gets transcribed, that red gene, you make a certain amount of mRNA, which then makes a certain amount of polypeptides in translation that make it red. But if you're a homozygous dominant individual, you have two copies of the DNA, and therefore transcribing that same gene is going to make twice as much mRNA, which then makes twice as much redness protein. And that's why you have the pinkness here, because the pink individual is heterozygous, therefore only makes half of the red pigment in a given amount of time compared to the homozygous individual. Okay, so that's the other than that, it's the same. And when you cross these F1s, then you get all three possible traits. You expect one quarter of the F2s to be homozygous dominant and therefore red. Two fourths or one half to be pink because they're heterozygous, and one quarter to be white. So it's not Mendelian. Really, is happening the same way. It's a non-Mendelian characteristic because of the way it happens here, and that's called incomplete dominance. Yeah.
So with incomplete dominance, does that mean it's a lot easier to tell the genotype by looking at the phenotype?
Yes. In this case, all you have to do is look at any one of these three, and you know not only its phenotype, but its genotype as well. So you wouldn't need the test cross in this case.
Because you just know from the results.
That's right, just by looking at them.
But I don't think that's universal for all the dominants.
Well, there's something else that comes into play that I'll talk about if I get to it today or still in this slideshow. And that kind of clouds the issue. Let's go to 12, though. And 12 involves a human blood group, the ABO blood group. Now, the ABO blood group in humans is famous. I'm sure all of you have heard of the ABO blood group. But there are really dozens of different human blood groups that have nothing to do with each other. There's all kinds of different ways that you can group blood based on these different blood groups. But the reason that ABO is the one that's so famous is because it's the one that can actually kill you if you don't pay attention to what you're doing. So it's clinically really important. The different blood groups have nothing to do with each other, though. And actually, there are two that can cause death. The AB O blood group and the RH blood group. And that's why, even though those two don't have anything to do with each other, that's why people's blood type, clinically, is usually given as a result for both of those, like AB negative. Well, it's AB in the ABO blood group and negative in the RH group. We're not talking about RH group here at all, just the ABO. There's two different exceptions to Mendelian genetics that this example is this blood group is an example of. And these two exceptions don't have anything to do with each other. It just happens to be that this is going to serve as two examples. One of the exceptions is called multiple alleles. Now, multiple here does not mean two or more, like it does in everyday language. Multiple means more than two. And that's why it's an exception, because one of those requirements for Mendelian genetics is that there's exactly two, right? Two alleles for the gene that you're talking about. Well, here you have more than two. You have three, actually. Three alleles. And this uses yet another standard for the genotype. The I here stands for immunoglobulin, which is a kind of protein acting as an antibody. It's important in your immune system. But anyway, that's what the I stands for. There's three of them. Three alleles in the possible in the population. Doesn't mean that an individual has three, right? An individual human is diploid and therefore has two alleles. Could be two of the same or different ones, but in the population, there's three possibilities. That's what makes it non-Mendelian. By the way, this specific immunoglobulin that we're talking about, I mean this I, immunoglobulin, this antibody, antibodies are produced and produced by cells originally, but put into the plasma of blood. Blood is an entire tissue. Whole blood is a tissue, a connective tissue, which means it has cells in it and it has extracellular stuff as well. The cells are the blood cells themselves. The plasma is the extracellular material that's part of the whole blood. And the plasma is where you find antibodies of all kinds. This is why you get vaccines, to produce antibodies that will be kept in your blood doing nothing unless and until you are exposed to something that particular antibody can detect as foreign material, and it will destroy it. That's why you survive if you get a vaccine. Well, here the antibody, which is in the plasma, is looking for or can recognize a particular shaped antigen. Antigen is the general word that refers to something that an antibody can detect. Okay? The antigens are carbohydrates that are produced on the surface of the red blood cells. And the blood type determines what the allele, which is really what gives you the blood type, the particular alleles that an individual has determines what kind of antigens these carbohydrates, these yellow carbohydrates on the surface, are going to be produced in that individual. All right? So there is a type A person. There's two ways that can happen. You can be homozygous for A, I super A, I super A, or you can be I super A, just I by itself, lowercase I, is the allele that actually doesn't end up producing any antigens. So the A allele makes the blood cells produce A antigens, the yellow triangles. The I by itself produces nothing. And so if you're either AA or A nothing, then you produce A antigens on your blood cells, and you're a type A person. But the same blood of that person, the plasma of that same blood, is where you find the antibodies. And therefore, a type A person who has A antigens on the cells has anti-B antibodies, not anti-A. If that person had anti-A antibodies, the antibodies would attack his or her own blood cells. So the antibodies in the plasma are looking for the opposite kind of antigens, right? And this is why you can't put type B blood into a type A person, because that type A person's anti-B antibodies will attack the antigens in that blood you're putting in. Okay, similarly, I mean, just the opposite for B. You can be B either of two ways, homozygous or heterozygous. But it's also possible for you to be a type AB. If you have an A allele and a B allele, then you produce both kinds of antigens on your cells. And therefore, in the plasma, you don't have either kind of antibody because either kind of antibody would attack this blood, right? And then another possibility is if you have two lowercase i's, that means you don't produce either kind of antigen, and therefore your own plasma antibodies come in both varieties, anti-A and anti-B. You detect anything with antigens as being foreign. All right? So this is one reason it's an exception. This multiple alleles means there's all kinds of possibilities. This doesn't follow the Mendelian rule because there's more than two possible alleles in the population. But I said that it's two exceptions. The other exception is called codominance. Which is different from incomplete dominance that we've already covered. Co means share, right? So there is a dominance relationship. And specifically in this case, A is dominant over O, which would be the lowercase I. And B is dominant over O. But codominance refers to the fact that two different alleles don't dominate over each other at all. And a result of that situation is that in an individual with one of each of the two codominant alleles, which would be an AB person, both traits simultaneously are expressed. What I mean by that in this case is that a type AB person is just as much a type A as a fully type A person, but at the same time, he's just as much a type B as a fully type B person. And that's why this person can't have either kind of antibody in the plasma. And this is why you have to be so careful with transfusion, and that's why everyone pays attention to the ABO blood group. All right, two separate situations there. Now we can go to 13. Actually, before we go to 13, I'm going to give you another exception that I don't have a picture of. And this will be the fourth exception to Mendelian genetics, is called pleiotropy. Is that showing up enough, or should I change markers? Well, as long as you in the front can see it, I guess that's good enough. Pleiotropy, this is not what we're looking at here. So just consider this to be slide 12 and a half. Pleiotropy is the situation in which one gene can affect multiple characteristics. Up to now, we've been in a situation where a single gene governs a single characteristic, like flower color, for instance, right? And that's all it affected. Well, with pleiotropy, the same gene can affect one characteristic and another unrelated characteristic. So this is kind of like a divergence. One gene, multiple characteristics. And even though I don't have an example to show you, one example is one that we've already talked about, which is sickle cell disease. Caused by that mutation, remember, in hemoglobin? Well, the fact that a person has sickle cell disease is bad. It's bad news to have the disease. And so you would expect natural selection, since having sickle cell disease gives you much less of a chance of surviving long enough to make your own offspring and pass that mutant allele on to the next generation, you would expect natural selection to phase it out eventually, right? You'd expect it to disappear from the population. But it doesn't, and that's because of something that's called the heterozygote advantage. A heterozygous individual for sickle cell means that one of the two hemoglobin alleles that that person has is normal. That corresponds to normal-shaped hemoglobin that functions properly for carrying oxygen, carbon dioxide. And the other allele on the other the homologue is the mutant form that corresponds to misshapen hemoglobin. That's a heterozygous individual. Well, if you're homozygous normal, then you are fully normal. All of your hemoglobin is normal. You don't have sickle cell disease, of course, right? If you're a heterozygous individual, if you're homozygous recessive, you have the disorder, and that's bad. But if you're heterozygous, that one normal allele you have is enough to keep you from actually having sickle cell disease. And the one mutant allele actually gives you an advantage over people who are totally normal for a different reason. Having just some of your hemoglobin misshapen because of being a heterozygous individual actually gives those heterozygotes increased resistance to getting malaria compared to fully normal people. And this is exactly why natural selection has kept it in the populations. Because heterozygous individuals are favored over both the other types of people. And heterozygous individuals pass on that mutant form, which will go into the next generation over and over. But anyway, this is pleiotropy because the same gene for the hemoglobin is simultaneously affecting two characteristics, namely the shape of the hemoglobin and whether or not there is resistance to malaria. Two unrelated characteristics. Sorry for no picture there, but slide 13, which we're now formally in, is in a sense, in terms of convergence, it's opposite of that, or divergence. I said pleiotropy is kind of like divergence, right? Because you have one gene affecting multiple characteristics. The opposite of divergence is convergence, which would be multiple genes affecting a single characteristic. You see that? And that is what's listed here, or what's exemplified in 13. It's called epistasis. Both of these words are often mispronounced, pleiotropy and epistasis. We just covered pleiotropy. That was the sickle cell example. Epistasis is a type of gene interaction. So you don't have epistasis unless you're talking about at least two different genes. But one gene affects the expression of the other gene. Now we've actually already talked about this, and even though I never used the word epistasis. Remember when we talked about eukaryotic transcription? Where transcription, if it's going to happen, has to involve RNA polymerase binding to the promoter of a gene, right? But I said that in eukaryotic organisms, it's often the case that RNA polymerase can't bind to that promoter and start transcription unless there are already proteins connected to the promoter. What are those proteins called? What's a word that we use often to refer to a protein? Well, that's an example of a protein. It's true that enzymes are proteins. Factor. Remember, I've used factor many times. Transcription factors was the answer to the question. Those little spheres on that slide were transcription factors that have to be there on the promoter first before RNA polymerase can actually turn that gene on, so to speak. Okay? Well, where do those transcription factors come from? The same place all proteins come from, right? By being translated from an mRNA that comes from DNA being transcribed. So, transcription factors are the product of certain genes, and those transcription factors then affect the turning on or off of other genes. That's the gene interaction I'm talking about here. Let's look at the specific example. How many characteristics do we have here? Okay, that's right. It's one, which is coat color, fur color, for these rats. But look at the genotypes. We can tell we're dealing with two genes here, even though it's one characteristic we're looking at, right? There's a set of Bs in the diploid, a set of Cs in the diploid. So two different genes, the B gene, the C gene. And they're both affecting one characteristic. That's why I say it's a convergence rather than a divergence like you see in pleiotropy. The B gene is responsible for producing the actual pigment. And there are two versions of pigment. So there's two alleles for the B gene. Upper B and lower B. Now, unfortunately, the two colors that result are black and brown, which both start with B. But black is dominant over brown, and so that's what the B actually stands for. Uppercase B is black, lowercase B is brown. All right? That's the actual pigment. But gene B is only going to make either black or brown pigment if it's turned on. And gene C, the coloration gene, is what the C stands for, is a gene that codes for a transcription factor that can turn B on. That means it doesn't matter what version of B you have if the B gene stays off. And the C gene is the thing that can turn B on.
So if C is off, B, it doesn't matter what B is.
That's right. That's right. And now look at these pictures. Every one of these white ones share the fact that they have double lowercase C, which means they're not able to make the transcription factor that can turn on the B gene. And therefore, it doesn't matter what the Bs are in these white ones. It would tell you what color the pigment would be if they were able to make it. But they're not able to make it because the C gene isn't allowing the B gene to be turned on. You see that? If you have at least one uppercase C, though, then that rat has the ability to turn on the B gene. And then you look at the actual Bs to see what color it's going to be. If there's at least one uppercase B, it's going to be black. If there's two lowercase Bs, it's going to be brown. Any questions on epistasis. Okay. Notice the 9:3:4 ratio. That's not Mendelian. This is a Mendelian exception. And 14 is another exception. The exception category here is called polygenic inheritance. So what does the word polygenic mean to you? Right, poly means many. So polygenic means what? Many genes, yes. So in polygenic inheritance, you have several different genes all contributing in some way to an overall characteristic. This specific example, represented by all these dots and squares, is human skin color. There's not just one gene for skin color. There's many genes, each of which contributes to the overall phenotype. Now, skin color is human skin color is caused by pigments. How much pigment is in the cells of the skin? And it's kind of silly that humans use the words black and white all the time. There's no such thing as a white person. There's no such thing as a black person. Every person is some degree of reddish brown. The reddishness comes from the blood that's flowing through the skin, and the brownness comes from melanin, the actual pigment that we're looking at here that's involved in these genes. And so how much pigment gets produced, it determines how much brown there is in the skin. But there's a continuum, just like there was a continuum for the electromagnetic spectrum, meaning two extents and everything in between is a continuum. There isn't just, like flower color, brown, dark brown and light brown, and those are the only two possibilities. There's all kinds of shades in between. And that's because so many genes are involved. That's really, I don't think it's specifically six, but that's what each zygote box here represents. These six circles represent there's six different genes contributing. And whether a circle is white or black determines whether or not melanin gets deposited. So when you contribute from all six genes, you can go from very light to very dark and everything in between. That's polygenic inheritance. Okay, 15. I think these are hydrangea, aren't they? Anyone know enough about plants? Well, even if they're not, these two photos. Obviously, well, if you're not colorblind, they're obviously different in phenotype, right? You can tell they must be pretty related. They look very similar in shape, right? So it looks like the same species, but obviously different phenotypes, different traits. Well, that can happen. Obviously, it happens in pea plants, purple versus white, like we've been talking about. It can happen because there's a genetic difference between the individuals, different genotypes. That's not what's happening here, though. These two individuals are genetically identical. So the big point here is that genetic composition of an individual only partially explains phenotype. How is it that genetically identical individuals can be so drastically different in phenotype?
Environment.
Exactly. There's a genetic component to phenotype. That's what we've been talking about all along so far. But there's also an environmental component to phenotype. And these two genetically identical individuals were grown in soils of different pH. That's a different environment. So they ended up having different phenotypes. I mean, you can imagine the same thing with identical twins. Remember, identical twins are created accidentally, right? It's supposed to be one zygote and it splits into two. So they are genetically identical to begin with. But if you separate those babies at birth, and they lead completely different lifestyles in completely different places on Earth, and get them back together 80 years later, they're not going to be identical still. Or just a more straightforward example, they could even live in the same house their whole life. But if one chooses to be a bodybuilder and the other one chooses to just lie on the couch all day, they're not going to be identical anymore, right? So there's an environmental component to phenotype, not just a genetic component. And that probably is the best place to stop for the week.